the meeting of the House Land Use Committee for Thursday, January 22, 2009. Today we will have an informational meeting. I want committee members to get a good perspective and background on all the different aspects of how the land use system in Oregon fits together and the different pieces of life in Oregon that it affects. So we will walk through invited testimony from people who have some very good perspective for us to learn about before we start digging into how the land use system might be improved. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Clem.
Excused.
Representative Cowan.
Here.
Representative Greenlee.
Here.
Representative Hannah.
Excused.
Representative Wingard.
Here.
Representative Vice Chair Garrett.
Here.
Vice Chair Escobel.
Here.
Chair Nolas.
Here. Thank you. So let's immediately go to invited testimony. I have asked each of our presenters to give us about a five-minute background on the perspective that their particular profession or organization looks at the land use system from. And then we'll have time for committee members to ask follow-up questions. We've organized it, Ms. Ross has organized it in panels so that there's subjectively coordinated, and so we'll have two or three people come up together and we'll take testimony from each and then open it up to questions from the committee for the entire panel. Our first panel includes Jim Labey, who's an urban conservationist with the Audubon Society, Evan Manville, who is the Legislative Affairs Director for the Oregon League of Conservation Voters, and joining us a little later, but hopefully still in time for this panel, will be Angus Duncan, who is Chair of the Oregon Global Warming Commission. If he doesn't make it for this panel, we'll ask him to join a different panel. Welcome, gentlemen. Mr. Labey.
Thank you, Chair Nolan and committee. My name is Jim Labey with Audubon Society Portland. We've been inspiring people to love and protect nature for over 100 years, trying to foster a region where people and wildlife flourish together. I haven't been that involved in land use issues in Salem, but this is the second time I've been down here in the last 2 weeks. We were down with a group of conservation groups last week speaking to LCDC about the petition for Goal 20 to address climate change, specifically sea level rise. So it's nice to come down here 2 weeks in a row. I've submitted written comments. I guess to start off, we'd say we and I say Audubon Society of Portland, but I wanted to add that we have been working with a kind of a caucus of organizations, the Nature Conservancy, Defenders of Wildlife, and others on submitting comments on the Big Look Task Force, trying to insert the importance of addressing natural resources in reforming the land use system, and to highlight the weaknesses that have been long recognized. And there's some good documentation that Defenders of Wildlife put together, a report called No Place for Nature that details a lot of the stuff I'm going to speak to specifically today. In general, the last 38 years of planning, land use planning in Oregon has been generally served Oregon well. However, there's structural imbalances and inadequacies in the planning program that really undermine and conflict with the state's policies and its investments to protect and enhance water quality, fish and wildlife habitat, and overall watershed health. The system's been great at separating incompatible urban and rural land uses, but has dealt less well with ubiquitous ecological processes that function across different land use categories in both the urban and rural landscape. And I want to just highlight a couple of the what we see as the structural barriers and imbalances in the system that really prevent and or thwart ecosystem-based land use planning. The first one really relates to having at least four natural resource goals that are, natural resource protections is scattered across about at least four goals, even more. We have goal five that deals with habitat, natural resources, historical areas, open space, and even things like aggregate resources. Goal six for air and water quality, and then goal seven for natural hazards planning. And a lot of these issues really need to be dealt together comprehensively, not in isolation. Local governments really rarely assist the cumulative degree of risk to wildlife, water quality, and public health and safety when adopting land use regulations or zoning designations for a particular that would allow development on a particular site. And too often, the separate application of these goals that are obviously related and relate to similar areas of the landscape really only balance one or two of these public values and associated private interests in these values with the interest in developing land. And I'm particularly aware of that in dealing with these issues in the urban environment. We've seen recently with the landslide issue emerging again. Part of that is not a failure to address these issues comprehensively at a watershed level. Secondly, the natural resource goals really lack, they really are process goals rather than outcome goals, and they lack adequate tools for protection, and they don't address restoration of natural landscapes. The goal 5 goal is really involves a long and complex process of inventorying and evaluating natural resource protection, but it ultimately mandates no specific outcomes. The process is really riddled, and we've been involved in this process for over 30 years in the Portland metro areas. It's riddled with opportunity to for natural resource areas to be removed from consideration and protection. So the state needs a clear set of specific objectives for protection and restoration of natural resources. Goal 5 really hasn't dealt effectively with our need to restore natural resources and restore the ecosystem services they provide our particularly our urban but also our rural communities. And finally, kind of related to that is that the goals 5, 6, and 7 aren't well coordinated with statewide conservation issues like the Oregon Plan for Salmon Watersheds and the Wildlife Conservation Strategy. Third, there's a need to plan for natural resources along natural boundaries, not just political boundaries. And that's something we've dealt with in the metro area quite fairly well by taking a regional approach to Goal 5. But too often we have jurisdictions doing, we have streams and wildlife corridors and floodplains that pass through these jurisdictions in different land use categories, but we're not developing policies that are consistent to manage the natural processes that flow through the landscape. The fourth is the plain system. And this is another one I think we've made progress on recently, but the system explicitly prioritizes protection of farmland and the provision of urban land supply over natural resources. We have local cities are required to expand UGBs to acquire a 20-year supply of just residential land and industrial land, not all the other things that are important to a complete community. And they're required to do that in expanding their UGBs. Required to avoid farmland first. So this essentially channels a lot of growth onto our natural resource lands. The Senate Bill 1011 that was passed in the last legislature has helped with that. We're working on that now in the Portland metro region, a new approach to thinking about really ecological issues associated with UGB expansion and making sure that we're pursuing the goals consistently in these decisions. But I think we need to, as important as farmland is, we need a better balance, and I think we need to rethink a mandate to provide 20-year supply of residential and industrial land without providing a 20-year supply of green infrastructure for cities, for parks, and for natural areas. Two last points, and then I'll pass it to Evan. I think part of the challenge in land use planning for natural resources is political, in that The commercial interests in particular land uses are well organized and politically influential, and that kind of entrenches the system's focus on particular land use categories and kind of fragmented regulatory authorities. And that kind of spillovers in a lot of our regulation of land use practices too, because different agencies in charge of these things. But there is this broad, diffuse interest in natural resources in both for economic and environmental reasons. So I think a genuine commitment to goal one is in the interest of better natural resource planning in Oregon. The last thing I want to mention is related to renewable energy facilities, and particularly wind power. This is something we're very engaged in, and it's obviously one of the things that's going to change big in the future. There's probably no other industries that's going to change the Oregon's landscape than wind power in the future. And Portland Audubon absolutely supports wind power and alternative energies. It's a matter of where and how. And we're at risk of making some of the same mistakes we made with hydropower in the last generation by not thinking through and having adequate regulations and policies in place to ensure that wind power is sited in a way, and that's where the land use process comes in, that avoids and minimizes impacts. And a lot of these impacts or the threats of wind power are known. The solutions are known to these problems, to the potential impacts. Part of it is siting, part of it is design, but we need a process that can address these things. And we've been seeing wind power projects go forward now that without adequate review and that pose significant potential risk to avian biodiversity in Oregon. Thanks a lot for the chance to come down and talk. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thanks. We'll go to Mr. Manville first and then open for questions for this panel. Mr. Manville.
Chair Nolan, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak. For the record, Evan Manville, Legislative Affairs Director for the Oregon League of Conservation Voters. OLCV is a group of about 4,000 members. We have chapters around the state, from Jackson and Deschutes County to Clackamas County to Lincoln County to Lane, Multnomah, Washington. We're interested in creating a legacy of a clean environment for our families. And land use planning is part of that legacy that we want to leave. Why do we care about land use planning? Because it reduces pollution runoff from paved surfaces. It reduces air pollution from having compact cities, creates transportation choices. It has healthier, more active people who are able to walk and bike. It protects our farming and forest heritage, and it means we have more funding available for environmental programs because there's less money spent on public services when we have well-planned cities. There are certainly some environmental challenges with our land use planning program as it's set up. Some of the wildlife challenges Mr. Labby explained. I also don't think it's yet ready to tackle climate change. The climate change challenge may be the defining environmental issue of our generation.
Madam Chair, excuse me. Is the recording system working?
Yes, it is. Thanks.
I was supposed to be blue when I...
They're using a backup system, Representative.
I see. I'm sorry.
Thanks for checking. That's work.
Chair Nolan, Representative Greenlick, I appreciate the posterity. Yes, we need to work on the climate change challenge, and I don't think the current system is yet set up to do that. Two main points I want to address in my testimony today. Apologies if they're duplicated from what you heard last week. The first is I want to talk a little bit about the history of our land use planning program, and the second is I want to talk about the idea that it's a one-size-fits-all program. First, with land use planning history, we've regulated land use pretty much since people have started living near each other. We've realized certain things don't go well together. For a while, we had common law nuisance laws. That didn't turn to be sufficient in the late 1800s as cities grew and became more dense. And we started using zoning in the early 1900s. Here in Oregon, we passed some zoning laws back in the 19-teens. We passed a partitions and subdivision law in 1955. We passed exclusive farm use zoning in 1963. And we started in with our land use planning program in 1969 with Senate Bill 10, as Mr. Kogan and others may have explained. Well, since 1973, what most people see is the start of our land use planning program, Senate Bills 100 and 101. We've continued to build and change the program. And hopefully this went over last week, but if not, let me reiterate. In 74, we passed our first 14 planning goals. In 1976, voters considered a ballot measure to repeal the program, and that was voted down. In 1976, we also adopted our four coastal goals. In 1978, there was another ask of the citizens, do you want this program? They said yes. In 1979, we created the Land Use Board of Appeals to make it easier and quicker to work through the system. In 1982, during a recession, a lot of which was blamed on our land use planning program, voters were asked a third time directly, yes or no. And they said, yes, we want our land use planning program. In 1991, we passed the Transportation Planning Rule, LCDC and ODOT, decided to work together to coordinate. 1993, we had House Bill 3661, which is a comprehensive rewrite of how we did farm and forest lands. In 1998, opponents of our land use planning program realized that they could not take it on straight up. So they started going after it on the ballot with obscure things. We had Measure 65, which was an attempt to repeal our land use planning program by making it easy to repeal our administrative rules. That was defeated. In 2000, we had another run at that, Ballot Measure 2, which voters defeated. We also had the unconstitutional Ballot Measure 7, which said nothing about land use planning, but with an attempt to repeal it. That was thrown out by the courts. At that time, and again in 2004 under Measure 37, when voters were asked, is land use planning program too strong? Only a third said it was too strong. They wanted to weaken it. A third said it was too weak, and a third said it was just right. So, and in 2007, after voters saw some of the implications of ballot measure 37 and that it was impacting our land use planning program, they of course passed measure 49 to redress some of that. So we have a long history. What of your body, the legislature? Well, in 1973, Senate Bill 100 was about 15 pages. Since then, 18 sessions. Between 5 and 15 bills have been passed by the legislature each session to change our land use planning program. This is a packet. The pink copies are the 1970s, the green 1980s, the yellow 1990s, the purple only the first two sessions of the 2000s. So when people tell you we have not looked at our land use planning program and changed it in 35 years, that is completely wrong. That is completely wrong, and I want to make sure you understand that. We certainly have a lot of faith in the legislature to make the adjustments as we move forward and to deal with changing circumstances. The second thing I wanted to address in my testimony today was the idea that somehow our land use planning is a one-size-fits-all. It's a great soundbite, and again, it's not true. We have 278 different comprehensive land use plans in Oregon, one for each city, one for each county. They're different. Our farm and forest laws have different protections in them for the area of the state, east side to west side, Willamette Valley to non-Willamette Valley. Our farmland laws protect a quarter of the farmland as high-value farmland and have weaker protections for the other three-quarters of our farmland. And our transportation and affordable housing goals vary. Some apply only to metro, some apply only to cities of over 25,000, some only to 2,500, etc. So when people say that it's a one-size-fits-all, again, it's a good soundbite, but it's simply not true, and I'll leave a handout on that, citing ORS, if you want to look at the laws yourself. With that, I will stop. Thank you for your time. I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay. Members of the committee, this panel is available for questions. Are there any questions? Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Mr. Labby. Interested in your testimony that natural resource preservation and restoration doesn't find systematic voice in the system. What would I'm new to this policy area. What does the department say about that? Is this are the things you're talking about more matters of administration and rule, or are you talking about statutory deficiencies, or both?
I would say that it's both. There's probably changes in, there's certainly changes in law, and I am less familiar with the administrative process at the state level. I know what one of the changes that has been kind of gradual here in the 2000s has been this attention on periodic review and trying to focus, emphasize particular planning objectives and say, well, you know, to prioritize that those things that local governments must look at in their periodic review process. And that's gradually made, I think made our system less comprehensive, the planning system less comprehensive, and it's meant that in many cases things like Goal 5, just due to budget reasons, get dropped off the plate in periodic review. There is some administrative ability for the staff to, I think, to deal with that, but it's when money is a constraint and you have these priorities that are emphasizing certain goals over others in periodic review, things like natural resources are the, seem to be always the first thing to drop off the plate. That's just, that would be one example I would, that I'm aware of at the state level. But I mean, the overarching imbalance is, I think, is where you have really clear mandates associated with one goals, one or two goals, and more of a process, open-ended process that for the others. And that's how I mean, I think there's real issues with funding, and there's solutions to that too. I mean, I think some of the best natural resource planning has been done with help from the federal at the federal level funding to do real comprehensive natural resource planning at the local level.
Okay. Any other questions, Representative Greenlick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kim, I've enjoyed culling your fervent notes out of the junk mail in the system. I have a question that I think follows on precisely on what you were just talking about. As you and others know, I've been very much interested in preserving the greater Forest Park, the Forest Park and its expanded area, which includes the Balch Creek watershed and particularly the wildlife corridors in and out of Forest Park and the summer and winter range and all the things that actually make that 5,000 or 6,000 acres a living park. But one of the problems that I've had in trying to deal with that is the whole question of all the different planning jurisdictions that have a piece of that action. City of Portland, Multnomah County, Washington County, Metro, for just a few, or for just some of them. And I've been trying to find a solution where we can integrate that in a more sensible way. How do you deal with these overlapping jurisdictions when the question of natural resources, such things as wildlife corridors, which you know can be 100 miles long, how do you propose we try and deal with that in the new way we look at that?
Well, in the Portland metro region, we've had the advantage of regionalism really institutionalized into the land use planning system. And I think one of the things that's good about the Big Look proposals is this push towards regionalism. I think that benefits natural resources because we can do the inventories, we can do some of the analysis across the landscape. That saves money too. It saves local governments money. And develop a program that recognizes the interdependencies of natural resources on a regional level. We've also been able, with Metro, of course, to launch the Regional Green Spaces Program with voter support, buy and acquire some of the best areas through acquisition efforts at a regional level. So, I mean, that the regionalism is in land use planning supports that approach. The other way we've dealt with that in Oregon is through watershed planning and the Oregon Plan for San Juan Watersheds, which is, of course, an entirely non-regulatory program. And I think that's we need to do more to make the linkages between watershed planning, restoration, and land use planning. And, you know, that's the other place that's kind of happening is through the surface water management agencies, but then, but they're, you know, they're not land use organization institutions, so there's a limit there. So land use is, it's if sometimes the when it comes to trying to deal with these issues on a watershed level, there's no really way to get the land use system to function at that at these, you know, scale of a watershed. So I guess that's how I would answer. I don't know if I'm specifically, I think generally regionalism helps. The other thing it's been key is that we've had the funding to do the natural resource inventory work at a regional level, at least some funding to do it adequately.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Follow up? No, okay.
No.
Any other questions for this panel?
I'll address that with other witnesses as we go along.
Okay. All right.
Thank you,
gentlemen. I would like to invite a second panel up, which would include Greg Winteroud, who is the president of the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association, and Peggy Lynch, who is representing the Oregon League of Women Voters. Good afternoon, Mr.
Good afternoon, Chair Nolan, members of the committee. Would you like me to go first or my colleague from Legal? All right, I'll go first. Peggy and I have known each other for a while. I'd like to begin by talking about our organization a little bit, some of the history, maybe begin to answer some of the questions I've heard from the committee to date, and leave it at that. The Oregon chapter of the American Association has been in existence in the state for about 60 years. The national organization began, I believe, in 1909, so we're also having our 100th anniversary. On a personal note, I moved to Oregon, like a lot of people who are planters in Oregon, from out of state in 1974. And I've had a career working at the regional level, at the Lane Council of Governments, at a time when the goals were being adopted. I've been the planning director for the city of Springfield, the city of Ashland. I've been in private practice for the last 20 years almost, and I spent five formative years of my life in the early 1980s working for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I think that my experience in many ways represents the breadth of our membership. We have planners who work for cities, for counties, for nonprofit organizations, for private developers, for neighborhood associations, for natural resource organizations. So we're pretty broad. We have planners around the state. So on our board, we have people from Morrow County, from Douglas County, from City of Portland area, from Lake Oswego, from the Medford area. So we bring a lot of background. The hardest job that I have in this organization is gaining consensus. So when I speak to you, I know that I'm speaking for a broad organization. We're really pleased to be here with the group of people, the League of Oregon Cities, the Association of Oregon Counties, the League of Women Voters. Jim Labby and I have worked on natural resource projects collaboratively in the past in places like West Lynn. This is a good group. There's a lot of history to be gained from this group, I believe. We have been more recently involved in the legislative process on land use and advocating strongly for the Big Look Committee for Senate Bill 92 in beginning around 2000, and it was finally adopted in 2005. Since then, we followed the Big Look Task Force closely, and we were sort of believed that the report that came out of that committee was half full. It was a good step. There are many good ideas on regionalism, on making an audit of the statewide system, on looking at areas of statewide concern, which could be a way, by the way, Representative Greenlick, to look at Forest Park. That is a state resource, absolutely. We also agree that there should be more emphasis on regionalism, funding regional projects where people can cooperate together. It makes sense to fund them at a higher level for things like transportation and infrastructure. We also believe that there needs to be a better statewide vision about where we're going. the criticism we have of the organization where I used to work, the LCD, is they become more rule-bound than we as an organization believe they should be, and don't have enough of a statewide vision. And this is a critique not only of LCDC, but of our state as a whole. Sometimes local governments feel like their hands are tied when they want to do good planning, and they're also asking for funds from state agencies. On the natural resource planning issue, since that's been brought up today, I'd like to give a couple of examples where I think the program has been quite successful. One is in the Forest Park area and northwest Multnomah County, where our firm actually worked on a natural resource plan for the county for wildlife. That plan has been implemented. There's good resource zoning. There's a fair bit of intergovernmental cooperation. It's not complete, but there's a lot of steps in that direction. And the other is like Oswego, where they have one of the most effective natural resource plans for urban natural resources in the state of Oregon through the Sensitive Lands Ordinance, where there's excellent inventories. They looked at alternatives, they looked at consequences, and they adopted a great program. Those are the good examples. And but where I agree with Mr. Labby is that it's nothing that you can count on. It's up to the local governments to make the Goal 5 process work, or in the case of Metro. So in other areas of the state, there's been very little attention to this. So you have very different types and quality of natural resource plans in cities throughout the state. That's something I think that could be given more attention. In terms of the Big Look Task Force, I think what I would like to do is not, we've provided some fairly detailed critiques and have alternative suggestions, but I think those should come at another time. I think the biggest point that I'd like to make is that the Big Look Task Force recommendations fell short. They didn't really look at the climate change issue. They didn't really look at energy conservation as a critical factor. And they barely touched on the issue of how regionalism might be married with performance standards to achieve more effective results in land use planning. Going back, way back in the beginning, I'd like to take you perhaps through my personal experience in this matter, which might be illustrative and help better understand. I know that Arnold Kogan has spoke to you. Dick Benner spoke to you also. They were two directors of the agency where I worked. But when I first came to Oregon in 1974, Senate Bill 100 was just in the process of being passed. The Oregon LCDC was being formed. It was all incredible effort to go around the state to be involved, to listen to citizens, to come up with the 14 initial statewide planning goals and Goal 15, which was Willamette River Greenway, and then later on the coastal goals in the later 70s. That was an enormous public involvement effort, much larger than anything that occurred with the Big Look Task Force. As an urban planner in the city of Ashland, where I learned actually a lot of my planning skills from Medford planners who were sort of my mentors at that point and have more experience than I. Medford was the first city planned to be acknowledged in the state of Oregon in 1977. And they are now, interestingly enough, in a pitched battle with the Department of Land Conservation and Development on expansion of their growth boundary and doing studies. Getting a plan acknowledged through the process is only the beginning. Implementing the plan, dealing with growth pressures or other issues. I was very fortunate as a 30-year-old to be hired by the Department of Land Conservation and Development during a very formative period of their existence. We were working hard to figure out what the general goals statewide planning program meant. I was charged with being the urbanization goal specialist. At the age of 31, I had to look Neil Goldschmidt in the eye and tell him the UGB was too large. It had to be shrunk back, and because there was too much farmland in that growth boundary. That was at least an interesting experience, especially when a lot of what we were writing had not been tested. There was not great case law. There were not administrative rules. We were helping inform commission policy, one acknowledgement at a time. And a lot of the law that we have now, for example, came out of the Portland experience. A lot of the law that has now led to things like the regional problem-solving effort that Medford and Jackson County cities are both, coming to a nearing an end after 8 years of struggle. It's been a difficult process to try to figure out a way to make growth work with natural resource preservation. These are very, very complex issues. There's been experiments in trying to provide for more regional autonomy. It's a very, very difficult task. We have ideas about that, but these, and so do many other people. I think that'll be a critical issue that this committee faces down the road, is how to deal with regionalism. The other issues that have had been effective in the statewide program is housing policy. Oregon has among the more progressive housing policy of any state in the nation. I've spoken several times outside of Oregon on the statewide planning goal 10, which requires cities to allocate enough land to meet housing needs, their regional fair share of housing needs. Oregon's housing law came directly out of New Jersey cases about fair share out of places like Petaluma, where they had court cases, on making sure that cities and counties bore their fair share. That's also an issue that you'll probably be hearing more about in terms of the question of clear and objective standards for needed housing. Under Goal 9, that's the economic development goal, there's a lot of tension, frankly, between state agencies to deal with this issue. The economic development folks at the state level don't always agree with the planning folks at the state level on the level of attention that should be afforded to economic development, how much autonomy local government should have in planning for economic growth along freeways. And every time a city goes to expand its UGB and economic development comes up, that is a controversial issue. It would be good to have more regional planning at that level, greater clarity in that process. And the big issue is the preservation of farm and forest land. Agricultural land is goal 3, forest land is goal 4, goal 14 is the urbanization goal. And there's tremendous controversy over the expansion of urban growth boundaries as our cities' growth boundaries fill up across the state. Again, I don't mean to pick on you, Representative Esquivel from Medford, but your community is in the heart of that situation as well. And so those questions about how to gain greater clarity in that process and how cities expand, how to make sure that as we expand, we don't use up the remaining farmland in the Bear Creek Valley, in the Willamette Valley, in the Umatilla Valley, even places out east, these are issues. The final thing I'd like to touch on is the perception and that there's a lack of, that there is a one-size-fits-all. In my experience, in working all over the state, we have done growth management plans in the last 2 years for Ontario and Pendleton. We're working on Eugene and Springfield and have participated in the Bear Creek process to some extent. Every time those issues come up, there has been, frankly, more slack given by state agencies to Eastern Oregon than you would find in the Willamette Valley. There's less draconian pressure put on those local governments. And I would submit to you that that's intentional. And it's recognized because we have a situation where that if you tried to apply standards that would apply to Salem to Ontario, they simply wouldn't work. So there, even though it's the same goals, there has been greater flexibility, and I have personally been involved in that flexibility than some people think. And I can see my time is up, so I'll end my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to listen to both members of the panel, representative, and then we'll open it up for questions for both of them. Ms. Lynch?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peggy Lynch. I'm with the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters is a grassroots nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. So I have provided you with three pieces, with three documents today. One is the letter that I'm going to skim through because being later in the panels, many people have taken care of some of the historical information. And then how the League makes determinations related to testimony is the land use policies, that is the one-pager that I pulled off of our web. And then I'm told that you also have the document called Land Use Progress and Challenges, which is the 2002 study that we did to update our land use policies. And the research contained in here is the kind of research that the League does when it makes decisions about participating in action in any kind of a legislative matter. So I hope that this is helpful. It gives you the 19 goals. Not everybody has them all in their heads, like you have heard some of the people today who have gone on with them. By and large, the League of Women Voters' first and continued goal has always been to make sure that the citizens of Oregon or the United States or whatever the jurisdiction is get a chance to participate in decision-making. So we realized in the late 50s that we were seeing some changes in Oregon and began studying urban growth. Then the 60s and the 70s, we realized that good land use planning and citizen participation in Oregon were going to be really important. You have already heard that in 69 we had the beginning of comp plans in Oregon. It wasn't just 73. But in 1973 we did have Senate Bill 100, and you heard from former Director Kogan that the League was there saying, we will help you with your two vans and your and your stacks of books and your charts and your little dots to assure that Oregonians could participate. And in this document, one of the things that I enjoyed as we put this together a few years ago, a quote from him, we've had regular good old citizens, unaffiliated, non-bureaucrat citizens at the meetings. Citizen involvement actually can happen in a positive way and actually can produce a consensus, even though not all people may agree on certain points. I love the quote. I thought it was a great idea. And what was important to learn for me, although I'm a native Oregonian and have been involved since the 70s, was not overly involved in this particular process. The first 10 goals were sort of came out of the legislature. Those were things that people believed in. But the next four goals, public facilities, transportation, energy conservation, and goal 14, urbanization, all came out of that public process. I share that with all kinds of things because it's so important for people to understand the public can actually do good things if you let us help in the process. It's also important because we often hear that our land use planning system is all focused on saving our agricultural lands and saving our forest lands. Certainly in the 70s, those were critical parts of our economy. And in fact, particularly with agricultural lands, they're still important to our economy. But the other thing that happened was helped us create livable communities. And those communities, one of the other comments, I enjoyed some of your statements about the fact that there are different comp plans all over the state. We often hear in this building the urban-rural split. The truth is, all of our cities all over Oregon are urban things when it comes to land use planning. Ontario is an urban place. Lakeview is an urban place. It may be in a rural setting, but they have the same needs to have places to live and jobs to go to work. They need to be able to shop. They need to be able to get there. So it's really important when we're talking about land use planning not to get hung up in this whole conversation about rural and urban divide, because it's because urban places, those 244 cities in Oregon are all urban places. So as I did bring for you, because I wanted to give you a little bit of a sample of the 1973, 74 through 80s process. The first community plan, and if Art Schlack is still here, he will appreciate this. The first community plan in Washington County, in part, was done on my dining room table with my neighbors. They had one half of one land use planner in Washington County. At the very beginning, we had the trusty-dusty maps, and I will hand these so that you can look at them closely, with the different colors, and you will see that some of the lots actually were divided in colors. This was pre the Fasano decision. So this was when we sort of said, yeah, we think this should be commercial, we think people should, this should be high-density residential, and this should be industrial. Those were the ways, that's the way we started this process. It was visionary, and we were trying to do the right thing for our communities. So we took from this, we went to individual maps of our community with individual lots, and my neighbors went lot by lot, inventoried each piece of property as to what was on it right now, sat down at our kitchen tables and said, what should it be tomorrow? What will make this the best community possible? And we created policies. There were limited numbers of policies. And we said, wait a minute, we have churches and schools in our community, and they really ought to have some sort of a designation. So it was our suggestion that there be an institutional comprehensive planning designation, so that we could be sure that and recognize that those were important things. That was 1978 when that was adopted. This is the 83 version. We actually got color then. It was a lot fancier. But again, it has lot by lot. It has the policies of this small community. This was the Raleigh Hills Garden Home area of Washington County. And I'm going to put them all together later. Anyway, you can look through those, but I just thought it would be fun for you to see the kind of history. You wanted history. There's some of the history of Oregon's land use planning program. It was not just done by the state. It is not just a state program. It is a very local program with different kinds of comp plans. One of the things that did occur later in the in 1981, as we realized we were finishing up each of these comp plans around the state, and we were we were thinking about some amendments needed to happen. What was the process for that? And so House Bill 2225 in 1981 was passed that created periodic review. For those of you from local government, I just saw you all have a heart attack because periodic review, where you periodically look at those plans and say, gee, is it still the same today as it was 10 years ago, became a cumbersome process and so involved in process that we couldn't actually do what we needed to do, which was to engage citizens again and ask them the same questions that we asked at my kitchen table in the 70s. What do we need today? What should we have today in our community? What different kinds of industrial needs are there? What kinds of shopping differences? We didn't have Walmarts back then. We didn't have those huge areas. We had mom and pop grocery stores. Economies change, and things are. Communities change, and we need to be able to figure out mechanisms to recognize that in a methodical, reasonable manner where we engage our local citizens. But like you heard with Mr. Labby, the truth is it's all in the dollars. Periodic review, engaging citizens in conversations, costs money. And we have lost that opportunity, and it's certainly one of the things I hope you take a look at. We started talking about reengaging Oregonians before before Major 7, before these kinds of things took place, but certainly by 2002, and that's why we put this document together, we knew that we needed to have a conversation with Oregonians about our land use planning system. There are people in this room who weren't alive then. There are people in this room who certainly didn't live here then. And we needed to go back and have a statewide conversation about how this program worked, which is what this document, I hope, helps you do. It provides you with some context about what were the successes we looked at. So what did we do that was good about this program? Talks about conservation of land, protection of farm and forest, affordable housing issue, increased transportation choices. The other thing that that isn't listed here specifically, but we need to be talking about today in these economic times, infrastructure costs. When you have compact urban communities, and that urban community can be, like I said, Vail, Gold Beach, or Portland, if you have those, your infrastructure costs are less. The other thing that's important is, so why did we come up, why did we grow the way we did? And I do like the comment that Rick Dick Benner shared, that one of the problems in Washington County and the reasons we're seeing some growth on some major farmland is that if you wonder why the region began to grow to Washington County farmland 15 years ago, follow the extension of the sewer line to the Rock Creek campus. So another of the things we need to make sure that we do is that we don't locate major entities in places that we want growth to be. And by selecting that Rock Creek campus area, which is really in some of the best farmland in the state, we encourage growth around that. So as you're looking at your Big Look recommendations, that's a sort of conversation. You will see that we also have a conversation about taking about private property rights, about the erosion of citizen involvement, which is of great concern to us, and a comment about enforcement. In case you don't know, and because you hear lots about all of the appeals that have taken place and how horrible it is that these citizens get in the middle of appeals, that is our enforcement mechanism. With the exception of the broader discussions that LCDC might have, where they may deal with comp plan amendments, the one-on-one land use issues, that plan that I shared with you, those community members continue to fight to protect that plan to make sure that the policies and the plans took place. And the only way they could do that was with appeals. Once the task force was appointed and meetings began, league members attended all but one of the task force meetings. We tried to encourage early public outreach and education, and the task force chose a different route. We provided testimony on issues that came before the task force, and we will provide testimony at the point that you hear House Bill 2229, specifically on the recommendations of the task force. We simply want to say that citizen involvement is critical, and you all know that as members of the legislature. It is critical to the land use planning program. It is the only way that people own policy is if they participate in it. And many citizens in Oregon participated back in the 70s. What we have not had is that same degree of ownership with a new set of Oregonians as we've had changes in circumstances and as they should have done updates to their comprehensive plans. I just participated with Benton County, who actually have done a recent comprehensive plan update. It's totally different than the comprehensive plan they did in the 70s and early 80s, because it recognizes the new circumstances and the new citizens and the new concerns of Benton County. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. I had at least one question for this panel, Representative Esquivel.
Question, actually. If you have an opportunity, I don't know if you've looked into our southeast plan in Medford. You have a Renco station up in the Portland area that's supposed to be one of the better planned communities in Oregon. It's about 40 plus acres, I believe, or 80 acres, something like that. Our southeast plan, which took 13 years in the planning, is over 1,000 acres. 54 landowners, and like I said, 13 years of discussing it, planning it. We have high density, we have commercial retail, we have schools, we have bike paths, we have pedestrian paths, we have lower density where you can get up to an acre with an estate home on it. It's a city within a city, and it's really a marvel to see, so I would suggest that maybe you take a look at that and go down and look and see how we're progressing with that, because it is a kind of a wonder to see it, actually. The regional problem-solving thing, that's why I have gray hair, is from the regional problem-solving. I was on the council when we started that, and now I guess there's a couple of communities are threatening to pull out of it, which in turn may unhitch the whole thing of 9 years, and we're working on 9 years, pretty close to 9 years of planning, and it's, and I'd like to put this in a perspective that legislators can understand. On a real contentious situation, very seldom can you get five or six or seven of us to agree. Exactly, and that's what we're asking regional problem solving. We're asking the cities of Phoenix, Talent, Ashland, Medford, Eagle Point, Central Point, and Jacksonville all to agree. So you can imagine what a feat that would be if we could, but of course a couple of these entities have changed their councils and they have new people. They don't understand it, so they're not going to vote for it. It has nothing to do with what's gone on in the past, but it's what's happened in the present. And it's very unfortunate, because I hope that we do not unhinge that process, because it also brought in spaces, open spaces between the communities, where you don't go from one community to the other and you've never known you went from one to the other, but it does allow for open spaces, and I think it's a great planning tool for regions. It's the only place in the state we've tried it.
Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, just a comment. The 9 years that it took means that there were at least 18 times the public, including new elected officials, needed to be touched, because we know that at least every 6 months people need to be reminded of policies that they agreed upon. And that is one of the challenges, and that's a mini version of the 30-some years of land use planning that problem that we have. If we don't have regular conversations about policies, people forget what they were or why we wanted to have them. Mm-hmm. And that's just critical.
Yep.
Thank you.
Excellent point. In fact, as you talked, Representative, about the 13-year process and then the 9-year process, I was tempted to ask who here on the panel could give us a perspective on what the legislature was doing with land use planning 9 years ago. Anybody? I'm the most senior member of the panel, and I wasn't here 9 years ago.
When it was 2000.
I joined the legislature 8 years ago. So I think part of the message there
sure,
is...
Sure, in those days, they agreed on everything.
Right? Part of the message is it's hard enough to remember 6 months later what you agreed to, but when you compound that with the turnover of new ideas and new energy that we all represent, it complicates it even more. Further questions for this panel?
Hey, Chair, I'd like to make a comment that goes with what Representative Esquivel just said. We're groping in my district with the planning for 800 acres in North Bethany.
Mm-hmm.
And you have, the problem is you have both the issues of how to plan for those 800 acres, but the certain knowledge that there's $250 million in infrastructure requirements to put that 800 acres into what's there already. So if that was just sort of 800 acres sitting in Mars, it would be enough problems, but you put it into an area where you can't drive on any of the roads right now, because there's traffic. The sewer system is probably broken. I mean, it really adds this incredible level of complexity to the planning problem. And I'm sure you must have had a very similar situation with the Medford.
Madam Chair.
Vice Chair.
Actually, I think that's why it took 13 years to get there. What we have, and I think we're kind of a pioneer in that we are looking at a long-range approach to our planning in my community, but we also oversize our infrastructure as we grow. Example, we have what they call SDC credits, whereas you may have next to town, you may have a five-acre piece that comes in that has infrastructure. So you make that individual put in larger pipes for sewer, water, whatever, for infrastructure. And then when it's tagged onto, then the individual, by the next person, they come in and they pay more, which in turn gives these people a credit. So it's a building block for your community, whereas you're having the first people oversize, and then as it goes out, then you can accommodate that growth. Otherwise, you can't sit here with, say, a 6-inch line when in actuality you're going to have 500 homes above that. You need to have a 36-inch line or a 60-inch line. So that's what we're doing, actually. And it took quite a while, but I think we did a very, very good job with that.
Good. And I know other members on this panel have seen similar kinds of issues for land use planning in their districts. I know Representative Wingard, there's been some, shall we say, interest, debate.
That's an understatement.
That
Mr.
Out?
Chair, I'm against annexation.
Any further questions for the panel? Yes?
Yeah, if I could just, this discussion led me to offer four points that I'd ask you to think about in the upcoming session. First of all, it has to do with infrastructure costs. That is the first, second, and third biggest issue we face in the state, and Bethany is a prime example of that. The second related issue, though, and this is the third time I picked on Medford, but I'm going to do it again. Back when the southeast area was added to the urban growth boundary, that was about 1990, Jim Eisenhardt was your planning director. I know this because I was working down there at that point. There was a major controversy, and this points to a issue that comes up over and over again in the state land use program. It also led to the inclusion of Bethany within the Portland Regional UGB. State law, not LCDC, but state law says that you must include exception areas, which tend to have a lot of houses and be in small lots, before you bring in farmland. There's good reason for that state law. We want to protect farmland in our state. But exception areas are very difficult to provide services to because they're cut up and they have houses on them. People don't want to annex to cities because they have services already and they don't see the benefit. They also are difficult to do master plans for. And one of the reasons Jim Eisenhardt, back in the day, won Southeast Medford was exactly to create the kind of complete communities that you're talking about. But he also moved up into grazing and pear orchard land. So there was a trade-off there. Some pear orchards, more grazing. No pear orchards?
No pear orchards.
Only grazing land.
There's a few almost, on the south end, but the most of it
almost
rock.
All grazing land. But so even that was called farmland, though. So that was an issue of tension between the state and Medford at that point. The third issue I'd like to touch on is the RPS process. You were wrong only on one thing, Representative Escobar. You forgot to say the county also had to agree with the cities on this process. They are a player. And they had to adopt it unanimously. You cannot have anybody back out. That is not a system that can work. And that's why RPS has been so difficult in part. Jacksonville, for example, has threatened to drop out. And if they drop out, the system doesn't work. So something to look at is the RPS statute.
Now Ashland's talking about dropping, saying no to it because they don't understand it.
And because they didn't want to have an urban reserve area, too, right? And so they were the one city that didn't have one.
Yeah.
And then the final thing is that urban growth boundaries. I think one of the reasons that Bethany was a problem is because when many cities, and I think Medford is an exception, looked at planning for public facilities within their urban growth boundaries, they didn't necessarily ask the question, cities and counties, what happens really 20 years from now? So not everyone oversized the lines to the edge of the UGB, anticipating that growth would go beyond that. The Medford process, the regional problem solving, is doing just that by looking at urban reserves. So you're ahead of the curve on that issue as well. So that I think that Medford area, Jackson County, is a really good example of some of the issues we face in the state in terms of good land use planning. So thank you.
Okay.
One follow-up.
We have application annex, so we really don't have a problem with annexation of people, because you have to apply and ask to come into our city.
Mm-hmm.
We don't force, like, I was surprised when I came here, that, like, some communities draw a line around there and say, this is our urban growth boundary, and then they, at one drop of the gavel, they annex everything. Ours is an application process, and it takes quite some time, but you have to ask to come into the city. It's very interesting.
It is. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, we do.
Thank you. I see only one member of our next panel, Mr. Schlack, representing Association of Oregon Counties. Is there someone here from the League of Oregon Cities? Dave.
I don't think that's correct.
Yes, an advocate for... Mr. Hunnicutt, I'm hoping that we will have an opportunity to hear from you soon, but Mr. Hunnicutt's not on today's panel. Linda Ludwig from the League of Oregon Cities had intended to be here, but I don't see her yet. So, Mr. Schlack.
Good afternoon, Chair.
Tell us about local governments and the challenges you all face.
Nice to see you.
In making this work. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Art Schlack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm a policy manager with the association, and I've already been dated and aged by Peggy Lynch at this point. So I'll acknowledge that I've been involved in the land use planning program in the state of Oregon since before Senate Bill 100. I was very young, but I was employed by Multnomah County in their planning department in 1969. So I've seen a lot of the Oregon planning program over the years at this point, and have been involved in it in various levels. I've provided you with it's entitled The Interest of Counties in Comprehensive Planning. It's a document that was drafted, as you can see, several years ago, and it deals with the subject that you are very much interested in. And I was surprised that 36 counties could agree on the document that you have before you, because we have 36 counties all involved and have an interest in land use planning, and they all view it a little bit different. But 10 years ago, we sat out to see if we couldn't put together a statement for the counties as it relates to their interest in land use planning and how they viewed it, and kind of where how they wanted to be involved in land use planning as it moved forward, as we continued the discussion with the state in terms of land use planning. And so this document is dated December 14th, 1998, and I will tell you, with respect to the document, it is applicable today as it was then, and it has been reviewed several times in the ensuing years, and it has not changed. The only thing that would change would be a couple of dates, and the fact that the document indicates that the authority for a local comprehensive plan is almost 90 years. Well, it's almost 100 years old at this point in terms of planning within the state of Oregon. Just by way of background, as I indicated, 100 years planning has been authorized in the state of Oregon, first by cities, and then in 1947 the legislature extended counties the authority to do comprehensive land use planning, and under the auspices of and the concept of local self-government, counties set out to do, a number of counties set out in the late 1940s and early 1950s to do comprehensive planning. And counties have been involved, continue to be involved today. As you know, the basic statewide land use planning program established under Senate Bill 100 is intact. It has undergone numerous adjustments or refinements, and we are now going to look at possible some more refinements with the big look and the recommendations that are being forwarded for your consideration. The issues relative to the effectiveness of the partnership, and we do view the land use planning program in the state of Oregon as a partnership between local government mm-hmm. and the state. Now, that partnership gets stretched and strained sometimes, but truly it is viewed as a partnership. Counties believe that the partnership should recognize regional differences. We have 36 counties, and there is a fine retired commissioner from Wallala County, Ben Boswell, who has coined the phrase, if you've seen one county, you've seen one county. And, you know, people laugh, but it's really true. We talk about the regions of the state, and we got 36 counties, and I think it's important that while there are some similarities, there are distinctions in those 36 areas within the state of Oregon. So recognizing regional differences continues to be a major concern of the counties within the state. I don't want to go through all this paper, but I do want to hit some high points at this point. It's important to recognize that county commissioners and judges, they are representatives of the people, just as the state legislatures are representatives of the people, so they have a responsibility to the citizens that they represent. They are concerned about the issues of those citizens. They are concerned about citizen involvement and the need to identify alternatives that are tailored to solutions that meet local circumstances. In other words, you know, we've got regional differences. One size does not fit all, and that's been discussed in this building many times. As partners and participants in the statewide planning program, counties strive to ensure that local comprehensive plan programs recognize, as I indicated, regional differences and the opportunity to address issues that are of a local nature. If I'd call your attention to the last page of the paper at this point, and land use planning in the state has evolved and will continue, and as I indicated, that partnership is one of the most important parts. It's important to recognize that the partnership is not just a one-way, that it winds up being a dual process. And where we've stretched the definition of partnership is when the state basically takes the responsibility to not only set policy, but they also establish the requirements and the and how the land specifically is to be managed. And that doesn't really represent what we look at as a true partnership. As you know, the legislature, we've got the goals, and we've got a lot of things in statute. And I would just submit to you that, at least on the county's ledger, agriculture and forest land is managed by the state of Oregon, either through statute or administrative rules. The counties are just the agent for the state in the management of agriculture and forest lands at this point. So it's important that we don't lose sight of the partnership, and that we can continue to work together and provide opportunities for the regions of the state to have viable communities and to continue to manage the land for beneficial purposes at this point. There are eight different, I'll call it, principles that the counties subscribe to that we look to as we participate in the discussions about land use within the state and in this building. We do want to ensure that the partnership is something that is a true partnership and that works in both directions. We work to ensure that local jurisdictions have the primary responsibility for land use planning involving issues that are clearly not of statewide concern. We also are concerned regarding programs that provide flexibility to ensure that the differences that exist between communities in the state can be realized at this point. That's why counties are interested in comprehensive planning in the state of Oregon. We view it as essential to the management and to the growth of the communities that are throughout the state of Oregon. And with that, Madam Chair, if there's specific questions, I'd be happy to respond to those. This is kind of a general approach as to why we are what we are and what our interests are.
Mr. Slack, I think it's both very helpful to have some of the guiding principles that counties collectively want to apply to the land use system, and impressive that they have withstood the test of time for now.
They have
10 years.
They have guided us through some very rough waters, as you can imagine.
Indeed.
Measure 7, Measure 37, Measure 49. There's a lot of these have been used to help us.
Okay. Commissioner Cowan.
Well, Madam Chair, I find it interesting to look at this document that I was serving on the AOC Board of Directors when we approved this document. And I believe it's part of a little booklet that I was part of a forward to. So it's kind of a walk back in time. So some of us have had involvement with this process for a long time, but not necessarily at the state level.
Not in this seat, but some institutional memory on the panel. Any questions for Mr. Schlack? Yeah, Representative Breiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate principles, but I, in two prior sessions sitting on the Land Use Committee, I heard testimony about decisions in individual counties that seemed to me odd. Seems that to the citizens of the county, particularly, is a little odd as well. To what extent do you perceive, is there a process by which we can believe that individual counties actually use these processes in real life in terms of how they approach?
Chair Nolan, Representative Greenlick, all 36 counties have comprehensive plans that have been acknowledged, and they follow those acknowledged comprehensive plans as they make land use decisions at this point. The land use area is, I'll call it an interesting one. And as a county planning director, there were many times when I was faced with making a recommendation, either to a planning commission or to my board of county commissioners, that I used to call 5149ers. The only trouble is, 51, you don't get a chance to walk the edge at this point. You have to make a recommendation, either to approve with conditions, or to recommend denial of an application. And sometimes if it's a close call, the citizens on one side don't agree with it, and the other citizens on the other side do. So these are not popularity kinds of decisions that commissioners and planning commission members are faced with at this point. They're faced with making a decision that is based on a set of guidelines and rules that have been adopted, And there are, from time to time, citizens that do not agree. And there are processes by which to seek changes to comprehensive plans and to the rules that operate in a county if they are deemed not to be supported by the citizens. And that's the process we have.
It is, great. Any other questions for Mr. Schlack? Okay.
Madam Chair, I look forward to attending your meetings and hopefully providing the committee with comments in the near future.
I have a feeling we'll be hearing from you again, and I hope so. We have one last member invited to visit with us today, Angus Duncan, who's chair of the Oregon Global Warming Commission and is president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation. Thank you for joining us. I know that you've had a busy day, and I appreciate your making time to.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for having me and for squeezing me in. For the record, my name is Angus Duncan, and I am chair of the Oregon Global Warming Commission, which just finished its first meeting of 2009 and its last resolution of 2008. We just voted to support the state moving forward with the Western Climate Initiative cap and trade, and the that resolution and the other resolutions that we have adopted over the course of the last 8 months will be coming to you as in the form of our statutorily required report to the legislature, should be within the next 2 or 3 weeks. So, Madam Chair, if I can, let me make some just introductory remarks about the commission, some general comments about the intersection of transportation or of climate change and land use, and then some specifics about where we believe the state's policies need to go in this regard. The Global Warming Commission was a product of your labors in 2007, where you set us up as a state commission with responsibilities that run across the entire spectrum of what the state does, but no actual regulatory or line authority and no budget. And while we might argue about the merits of, you know, setting us up on those terms, in fact, I think it has obligated us to move in a very constructive way, to recognize that we need to collaborate with state agencies and with interest groups and stakeholders if we're going to accomplish anything as a commission. And so our practice, our approach, our strategy, if you will, has been to try to work with the agencies through a series of subcommittees where there are existing stakeholder processes, such as the Transportation Vision Committee or the Energy Efficiency Working Group or Big Look, to try to work through those as well. And in the end, try not to bring you a separate Global Warming Commission product, but rather to bring you our ability to support where we can and to critique where it's useful the products of these other stakeholder processes or of the agencies. And so the resolutions that you get will reflect that approach. We, as I say, made the effort to engage in that kind of a collaboration with the Big Look Committee last year, found a receptive audience in some of the members, but on balance, it was not a very successful collaboration. I've given you initially the letter that we sent to Big Look that suggested areas where we thought it was important for Oregon's land use policies and Oregon's climate policies to intersect and to interact. And we've now taken that letter, converted it into a commission resolution, sent it to LCDC, and actually last week held our first formal discussion with LCDC. Myself and another one of our commissioners went down and met with that commission last week and walked through some of both the mitigation and adaptation issues that we had identified for Big Look. So, general comments on this point of intersection. I guess the first comment is that climate is a big issue, and it tends to invite big solutions, and it tends to sometimes keep all of its focus on big solutions. So we spend all of our time talking about, you know, national carbon cap and trade. But as a practical matter, greenhouse gas emissions, you know, result from some big choices, but from an awful lot of little choices as well. And they are consumer choices, and they are zoning board choices, and they are, you know, individual business choices, you know, a choice by a driver to drive or take the bus. All of those things add up to the greenhouse gas emissions totals that we have seen climb inexorably since we first started counting greenhouse gas emissions back in the early 1990s. That, by the way, was when the state adopted as a benchmark that our emissions should not grow above our 1990 levels. And when we started working on this issue with Governor Kulongowski in 2004, we were at 18% above 1990 levels. We're now in excess of 20% above 1990 levels. So we have to deal with this, with emissions on both a very large scale and a very small individual focus scale. Deal with those choices that are affected immediately by zoning and urban design, by transportation infrastructure investments, by building codes. So that's state policies, it's local government policies, and it's business and household decisions. I think it's equally important to note in commencing or thinking about this that there are at least as many opportunities for gains as there are demands for enduring costs or making changes that are uncomfortable. Generally, this is also an area where, unlike a lot of other state policies, there are some complementary opportunities for both urban and rural areas. You know, fundamentally, urban areas are areas where energy efficiency is most easily acquired. Our urban areas are our most efficient areas. If New York City, with all of the leaks from its steam tunnels, was a state, it would be the most energy efficient state in the union. Not because, you know, they are more assiduous than we are at energy efficiency, but because they live in a dense urban form. They have mass transit. They walk. In fact, walking is usually a whole lot faster than trying to get in your car and drive in New York City. They live in common wall buildings, which themselves are inherently more energy efficient than separated housing. Not to say we should all turn into New York City. It is to say, though, that the energy efficiency opportunities in cities are very substantial, and they usually end up making us money. I used to serve on the Northwest Power Council, and I asked the staff at one point to tell me how much money we had invested in just electric energy efficiency over a period of 20 years and how much we'd saved. And we had invested something on the order of $2.5 billion in electric energy efficiency at the time. We recovered that $2.5 billion in energy cost savings once every 26 months. If you do the math, that's about a 40 to 50% average annual rate of return. And even in a good market, there weren't very many opportunities like that. And they continue. We think that there are somewhere between 3 and 6,000 average megawatts of additional just electric energy efficiency available in this region that's cost-effective now. And we need to acquire almost every one of those megawatts if we're going to hit our greenhouse gas targets. In rural areas, there are still energy efficiency opportunities, but there are also most of our renewable energy opportunities. That's where the wind is, that's where a good deal of the sun is, that's where the geothermal is, that's where the biomass is, and really the major contribution that rural Oregon is going to make is in developing those resources. There's money to be made there. There are impacts to be measured and lived with there. But when I see our strategy for reducing greenhouse gas emissions unfolding, I see it unfolding as efficiencies in urban areas and renewable energy in rural areas, and huge opportunities in both places. land use and climate considerations, we have tended historically to think that these interact mostly in trying to figure out how to adapt to changes. You know, if water supplies are going to be constrained, if snow melt is going to be earlier, if there's going to be less snow and that impacts water and then it impacts ecosystems, we tend to think that those are where land use issues and greenhouse gas issues, you know, reside primarily. But again, there are huge land use opportunities in developing our mitigation strategies as well, particularly in developing more efficient urban forms and in figuring out how to take advantage of the renewable resources that we have in great abundance compared to most of the rest of the country, but to do so in ways that don't violate, you know, the integrity of our land uses or the community and farm and forest values that are inherent in our land use system. So those are some general comments. Some very specific areas where we see these interactions taking place. Within mitigation, within reducing greenhouse gas emissions, we see particularly opportunities in transportation investments. And the transportation package that Governor Kulongowski has forwarded to the legislature is the product not just of the freight companies and the Department of Transportation and the cities. It is also a real product of our commissions engaging directly and through, if you will, sympathetic proxies like Commissioner Ackerman in trying to send to you a transportation package that is also intended to conform to meeting our long-term greenhouse gas reduction goals. So, for example, for the first time in transportation planning, we've proposed, the governor has adopted, the Department of Transportation, the commission have adopted the notion of doing least cost planning in transportation the way we have done least cost planning in utilities and electric energy for the last 25 years to great advantage. They are different kinds of planning, but that kind of least cost planning that also wraps environmental costs and benefits along with economic costs and benefits has ended up being as productive, because it's ended up being as productive as it has in electric energy. You know, we think that comparable gains are going to be available when we apply some of those techniques and modeling exercises to transportation. And in fact, we are in the process with ODOT right now of developing what we think will be the first modeling tool in the nation that allows us to look at transportation and land use choices and solve for greenhouse gas outcomes, or to reverse it, to set the greenhouse gas outcomes we are looking for and work backwards through the model to the kinds of transportation and land use choices that will get us there. It's called GreenStep, and if it pans out, it will, as I say, be the first one of its kind in the nation and something that we will be able to first use statewide and then, we hope, take down to the MPO level and to the local government level. And that's the second piece I wanted to identify, you know, with respect to mitigation, is that within the governor's transportation package, there is the requirement that the MPOs and at least some of the local governments do this kind of transportation, land use, building code, and greenhouse gas emissions planning, and the legislation asks our commission to figure out how to take those overall state goals and disaggregate them down to local community level, which we think is a tremendously important thing to do, and we haven't quite figured out how to do it, but we will, because it's going to be important for local governments to, if they're going to carry their share of the load of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, that they also have the tools that allow them to do that. And right now, they don't. You know, we can't require it if we don't give them a way of accomplishing it. So that's very high on our list. Generally, the that GreenStep model
will incorporate issues like density, like urban growth boundaries, VMT reductions through access to alternative modes of transportation, different levels of transit service, walkability, just the ability to have access to services within walking distance of your house, is going to be, in the end, a tremendously important piece of this puzzle. So you don't have to get in the car to go to the grocery store for a half gallon of milk. You may still choose to get into the car to go to the grocery store, especially if you've got a whole lot more to haul home than a half gallon of milk. But having that kind of local immediate access and starting to shift our urban form and urban design so that there are stores and services and parks that are within walking distance of people's homes is going to be a part of the puzzle. Building codes, particularly the options to move toward more common wall housing that is more energy efficient, something that that in the electric utility industry we call smart grid, but which will have some real implications, especially in local communities. Smart grid basically says you take that central grid generation that historically we have relied on, and you link it up through the transmission system with smaller, more distributed generation sources, which could be photovoltaic panels, could be fuel cells in the basement, could be any one of a number of things. Link those to storage technologies, which could be a fuel cell, could be simply the ability to cycle a hot water heater on or off on demand, so that ultimately you end up with a grid that that is not just a one-way pipe from Bonneville Dam to your toaster, but in fact links your toaster to, you know, my toaster next door, to my plug-in electric vehicle out in my garage, which is used by the entire grid as both a load on the system and as a storage unit. It's battery plus 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 other vehicles can end up serving as, in effect, reserve storage capacity for the electrical system. But that's only going to work if we figure out how to develop a network of both private and public charging stations. So how are we going to work those into our local zoning and planning laws and our local urban development and infrastructure investment decisions? In rural areas, we have a series of issues as well. Particularly, I would just mention two. You know, one is that community densities are going to be as important in some ways in rural areas as in urban areas. Walkability is going to be that much more important, so that people in those local communities who historically have been able to walk to services can continue to do so instead of getting in the car and driving to a Walmart 15 or 20 or 30 or 40 miles away. That becomes even more important if the cost of driving goes up, which it is going to, both because gasoline costs are going to go up and because carbon costs are going to be added in and push those even higher. So how do folks in rural communities get to hospitals when they need them and there's not a hospital in that local community? Clearly, we are going to have to go back and revisit our inner city, you know, alternate transportation services so that we make sure that we are not in the process of increasing the cost of transportation, also isolating people in rural communities. There are renewable energy generation and transmission siting issues that are going to be important. Renewable energy can be a really good neighbor, but it can also be a bad neighbor. So can a large transmission line. And we are going to need to see more of both of those in our rural areas. So we need to start planning ahead for how we create those alignments and how we negotiate those with local communities so that the local values are not, you know, run over in the process of using eminent domain to site a new power line, but we still get the new power line sited if that's what we need to do to meet our greenhouse gas goals. That's just a little of the flavor of the mitigation issues. The adaptation issues, you know, are basically fire and water. If you want to consolidate them into two words. There are some other issues, but fire, and especially forest fires, you know, becoming a very large issue in Oregon, and how we manage our forests, both to try to maintain forest health and to be able to make use of those forests carefully for biomass generation. There are obviously going to be a set of farm and forest issues associated with biomass production generally. Some of that goes to existing forests. Some of that's going to go to new crops that are going to have to go in and new conversion plants that are going to have to be located on farms or near farms where that biomass can be converted to energy and then transmitted into the system and get from, you know, Harney County or Umatilla County across the mountains to Portland. Water is, we honestly, I think, are still, you know, half in the dark about the impacts to water in Oregon. The science tells us to expect more precipitation and less snow, but it can't tell us exactly where the precipitation is going to come from, our land. It suggests that we will probably see more of that precipitation in the winter, but depending on the interaction between where the snow is and when the precipitation is falling as rain and not snow, or worse, rain on snow, you know, we can end up with more flooding. It's worth all of us reflecting on the fact that that it's hard to remember an occasion when I-5 was stopped up for 4 days for any reason, at least in my lifetime. But we've had a multi-day stop up in the Chehalis Centralia area 2 years running from excessive flooding. Now, again, no one can point to any 1 year or any one flood and say that's global warming, but what they can do and what the science tells us is that's the kind of event we need to expect more and more often. Do we pick up that entire intersection and move it? We may. There are a whole set of issues involved in the alignment of 101 along the Oregon coast, because there are significant chunks of 101 that are vulnerable to sea level rise that is already taking place. And if you haven't seen Dogami's, you know, positively chilling presentation on watching that sea level rise and the impacts already visible on the Oregon coast, I encourage you to do so. So I-5, 101, 26 has now been stopped up twice due to slides from early snow melt around Mount Hood. So we're looking at public infrastructure that also is going to have to adapt to more flooding in the winter and the spring, but we're looking also at agriculture and in-stream uses that are going to have to deal with less water and warmer water in August and September than historically we have dealt with. So fire and water and other considerations are on our adaptation agenda, and they're going to have to be on yours too. And I think, Madam Chair, with that, I will, you know, I'll put a period to my presentation, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to respond to them.
Thanks for putting the whole thing in a context, although it's daunting what you've presented.
It's a downer of a context.
Do we have questions for Mr. Duncan? Yes, Representative Greenlick.
Thank you very much. First of all, I'd be interested in seeing that the Gami presentation. I suspect it may have some land use significance that we may want to talk
about. It may. I'm starting to get very jealous of the committee's time. We should think of whether there's some time when we could do
I think
that.
You might be able to get it in PowerPoint form sent to you, because they do it as a presentation.
And if the committee commits to doing the homework it already has, then I might be interested in giving the committee more homework. Is that the only point you wanted
no,
to make,
I'd
Representative?
Like, I'd like that question. You raise the issue of building codes, and I've been trying to figure out how to access building codes on a relatively small issue that will affect GHG, I think, emissions. And that's the question of outdoor lighting. Mm-hmm. I got to this first by the question of light pollution, but the more that I studied it and the more that I studied codes that are coming out, it's very clear to me that there are two problems with outdoor lighting now. One is that it's omnidirectional rather than unidirectional, rather than getting down the ground, and the other that it puts too much light on the ground so that it bounces up in order to achieve it. It's very clear now, and I've been trying to figure out how to get it into the governor's energy package or somewhere, that if we had building standards that required unidirectional lighting and the proper amount of lighting, it saves about 50% of the energy. But I don't know how we access those building codes for these kind of green solutions, particularly ones that are relatively modest. I mean, it's not...
The relevant statistic I saw with respect to outdoor lighting is that just in the electricity used on the lighting that escapes upward that really isn't lighting anything of value to us, you know, we waste about $10 billion a year in electricity to light up the sky. That's a lot of money. If we could shift that to more efficient lighting, we would save capital dollars and we would save operating dollars. Historically, in this region, really since the early 1980s, what we have done by way of practice is to introduce new technologies or new applications of the sort you describe, first on a voluntary basis, and then as they tend to get deployed, they also tend to find their way into code. And once they're in code, they are the least expensive energy savings we've been able to acquire. So I don't know the exact answer to your question of how you get that into code, but I do know that that certainly the utilities are very aware of the issue of inefficiency in outdoor lighting. I'll raise that question with the Department of Energy and with the PUC and see whether, you know, there's, at a minimum, there is certainly a way to address that programmatically, and there may be a way to address that in code as well.
Can I follow up?
Follow up?
Very briefly. The Department of Energy is interested. We passed a bill in the last session that helped get them interested. Now it's the next step. But my question is that $10 billion a national number?
Yes, I'm sorry, that's a national number.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? You've kind of knocked the wind out of us. Thank you.
I didn't give you the last page. Madam Chair, let me just add one more statistic, because this bounces you up a little bit more. When we adopt proposed goals to the governor back in 2004, the advisory group, we proposed a 2010 goal, a 2020 goal, and a 2050 goal. The 2010 goal was that we would take that inexorably trending upward line of greenhouse gas emissions from Oregon, arrest its growth, and bend it back downward. And with the work you all did in 2007, and a series of other administrative measures, and even without the recession, we were on track and are on track to meet that first goal. And I think that's something we should all take a little bit of heart in, that these goals are aggressive, but they are doable. And we're going to do the first one.
Great.
Thank you.
That is good news. Thank you. Committee, I would like to call your attention to this concludes our invited testimony for today. And our agenda for next week. On Tuesday, we will start to dive into some of the work of the committee. Specifically, we will hold the first public hearing on House Bill 2229. Which is the bill that contains the recommendations from the Big Look Task Force. To set the stage for that, I have invited a representative from Portland State to pull together some of the history we've had last week and today in kind of bullet points about some of the evolution that has happened. I have also asked Oregon State University to come and present the findings of an evaluation that they were contracted to conduct, essentially an audit, if you will, of the land use program in Oregon and its effectiveness in reaching the goals that the legislature and the public set for it. In a pretty focused and concise way. And then we will have the co-chairs of the Big Look Task Force, Senator Mike Thorne, former Senator Mike Thorne, and current County Commissioner Nikki Whitty, present the findings of the task force. I somewhat flippantly referred to homework, but I would very seriously make a request of committee members that you familiarize yourself with two documents that you have access to. One is the report that the Natural Resources Institute produced of its evaluation of the effectiveness of the land use system. In keeping with their ethic, they have not produced hard copies of that report, but it is available online, and Ms. Ross has sent you all the link for that. In the documents she sent you earlier this week, they looked like this. They probably also came to you electronically, am I right? Or did they come in paper? No, that one. Yes, came in paper.
Hard copy.
So she's got the link for that. Where did I see that? Here, right in...
That's the Big Look.
That's the Big Look. What about the... Oh, you don't have this in here, or do you?
All the pertinent documents, Madam Chair.
All the pertinent documents, including the Natural Resource Institute evaluation, are available at that link.
Oh, at that link. Not in this pack.
The Natural Resource Institute's report is very substantial. It's 165 pages. I would ask that you at least familiarize yourselves with the executive summary before we hear from them on Tuesday.
Is there going to be an exam?
Yes, there will. It will come in a form that may surprise you, but there will be.
Will it be in the whole report or only part of it?
Cliff notes will not suffice. If we're going to make informed decisions that affect this whole system, I think we need to at least understand whether the current system has achieved the goals that the public and the legislature wanted it to achieve. Because as you saw, the document that Mr. Manville presented to us, I would personally submit that 30 years of amendment to the land use system is driven by a number of different forces, one of which is adjusting to individual needs, circumstances, geographic differences, compactness differences, those kinds of things. I would also submit that to some extent it is driven by each new legislature thinking they've got the solution, and by God, I'm going to fix what those guys last year or 10 years ago screwed up. I would like us to understand what is there before we think we have ideas about how to fix it.
Is this basically the index to that fat?
That's another thing I wanted to draw people's attention to, yes. This, Ms. Ross also provided us with the index of that thick document. This is just an enumeration of each individual bill that the legislature over the last 35 years has added to, in a few cases repealed, but changed the system. And, I mean, this is pretty remarkable. Yes. This is the document that Governor Attia had referenced that is helpful. The other piece of background, because we will be hearing from the task force, I think committee members would do well to read the report that they have produced. This one is actually a pretty decent read. Certainly the executive summary, which is only a few pages, should be familiar to everyone. This one, I think you will find it well worth your while to get through the entire thing. Talks about the outreach they did. We didn't do quite as much outreach as the original Senate Bill 100 and the establishment of goals, but they did a very impressive job of listening to regular folks across the state. They held a lot of meetings, so it would help us all if we could do that. And as I said, this is the first public hearing on that bill. We will just have that testimony at this hearing, but colleagues, I intend for this committee to have several public hearings about that bill in which we'll take a variety of public testimony from the people who track this rigorously, as well as from regular folks. So that's where we're going. We will have then, on Thursday, we'll have another opportunity to hear from advocates or people who represent particular aspects of this whole system. I have heard from some members of the committee for recommendations on people we ought to hear from. Representative Wingard has sent me an email recommending someone to testify. Representative Hannah has sent me a couple of suggestions. Representative Esquivel made some suggestions. Feel free to stay in touch with me about people you think we ought to hear from if you don't see them either on today's agenda or on the next one. There will be plenty of time for us to invite people, and when we have public testimony, there will be time to for people who haven't been invited to still come and testify anyway. Questions about that discussion?
Would there be some use to having an evening session so some of the ordinary people can join us?
I think, Representative, it would be worth our talking about the practicality of that and the value of that. I think it might be worth scheduling at least one opportunity for folks who have day jobs that don't involve the legislature to come and talk to us. So we'll take that into account. No further questions. We will adjourn until next Tuesday.
So does Sandy.
Wasn't here when I told him 5 minutes.